Baie welkom almal. Welcome everyone to this discussion about sort of centered around Sihle Khumalo's book Rainbow Nation, My Zulu Ars. And it's lovely to have two wonderful, well-traveled, renowned authors here on the couch today. Like I said, Sihle has recently published his latest book. He's the author of at least three previous books that I'm aware of, being Dark Continent, My Black Ass, when he traveled through Africa via public transport. And then there are two other travel books, Heart of Africa and Almost Sleeping My Way to Timbuktu. And then, of course, this new one. And sitting next to him, a guy who needs a little introduction here in Stellenbosch, is Dana Snyman, who's also written probably close to 10 travel books by now, if not more. Your most recent one was Oppat, Nedana. And a few years back he wrote Op die Achterpaaie, On the Back Roads, was the English translation. And it's wonderful to have specifically these two authors on the couch here with me today, because in Sihle's book, Rainbow Nation, My Zulu Ars, he almost a kind of a dialogue, not a dialogue, a discussion, or a constant reference to Dana and his book, Op die Achterpaaie, On the Back Roads, which formed to an extent, which was inspiration for Sihle while he was doing his journey across South Africa. Just before we start, and before I start asking questions, a little disclaimer or a footnote that of course, this interview session is going to be in English. It's none of our first languages, but I'm sure we're going to be cool and we're going to cope with it throughout, and I'm sure you too. Sihle, I really, really enjoyed your book. It's a fantastic travel log of, it's almost a bit of a stock take of South Africa, but it's also a lot more. I can really recommend Sihle's book, also in terms of the historical figures that he focuses on, and just his own almost internal monologue as he travels. A lot of the things that you refer to about, I really found it very meaningful. In terms of traveling, you did this trip alone. Oh, well, your first day or two were with your family, but then you went at it alone. And Dana, you also travel alone quite a lot, almost exclusively. Yeah. What made you decide to do this trip alone?
Well, with all the other trips that I've done, as you rightfully said in your introduction, that I'd done the Cape to Cairo. That was my first major adventure, and then subsequent to that, I did Central Africa, and it was only natural that once I've done Cape to Cairo, which is more on the eastern border of the African continent, and then Central Africa, it was only natural that I do West Africa. And then I thought it was only fair that after I've explored so many other African countries that I explore my very own country, it was a conscious effort that I should travel alone, except for that very first day when I traveled with the wife and the two kids. And the reason for that, it's actually a number of reasons, but part of it is just a practical issue. You know, when you're traveling by yourself, you do not have to deal with group dynamics. You do not have to get to a spot and you like it, but other people do not, or vice versa. And you get to a spot and yes, you just feel, I just want to live here, but other people say, no, let's spend the night here. So there are no group dynamics. You do not have to wake up in the morning and somebody's not feeling well or is having a bad day, and now just because you're having a good day, now you have to also feel bad because another member of the group is feeling bad. But more than anything else, specifically for this trip, it gave me an opportunity, as I was driving, it gave me an opportunity to reflect. I could switch off the radio for long periods of time, obviously while still concentrating on the road, but also just to make sure that I could think things through. Whereas when you are traveling with other people, you could never do that, because then you have to put on this CD, another person wants this radio station, another person wants the other radio station. So traveling alone actually gives you a lot of time to think about a wide variety of things, and that is by and large the reason why I thought I should do it alone.
Yeah, you early in the book, I found the quote quite inspiring, and he very eloquently states, "Life's a journey, so shut the fuck up and travel alone."
That's it, eh? In any way you look at it, life is a journey. Sometimes we tend to think, if this happens, you know, I will be done with life. But life, as for as long as you are alive, you'll really realize that life is a journey. And part of that journey involves you and I traveling. And for me, it matters most that I travel alone. So that is what I'm saying in the book.
Donna, I'm sure there's a lot that Sisley has just said that you can agree with.
Yeah, for sure.
What's your take on going at it alone on the open roads? Maybe your dog sometimes going, but...
Yeah. Shucks, I must think in English now. Here, it feels real. Sorry. It feels like ek is nie. Hello? I say altijd, I grew up in Daniel's Kuil, Northern Cape. And by, I think I was like 12 years old, I only know two English words.
Right.
Fort and mobile. Now, yeah, to travel alone, yeah, sure. I prefer that as well, you know, exactly for the same reason, you know, to think things over. And yeah, when I travel, when you go, you maybe you listen to a CD or the radio is on RSG or something. And then once you get it later off, you just switch it off.
Mm-hmm.
And I like to these days to open the windows as well.
Oh.
I'm irritated by modern cars.
Why?
Really, I have a new Hilux Bucky, or second-hand new Bucky. But I have a Datsun 1400 as well.
Mm-hmm.
And really, on a long stretch, I for long now my Nissan 1400. Because it feels like you're driving. It's not like this illusion of flying or gliding.
You want the real thing.
Yeah, you must feel. And there was wind come in at places where you don't want it to come in. And
yeah.
It gets hot. And I really like it. I'm quite very irritated by the whole motor industry and this illusions they're selling.
Mm.
Like driving mustn't be driving anymore. It must be something else. I like to feel the road. Yeah. Oh, that's...
Did you feel the road when you were driving? Because you did. Sisley traveled for roughly a month, and he covered just below 9,000 kilometers, South Africa.
Talking about feeling the road. I mostly travel through tar roads, and that is one thing that we underestimate sometimes, is the great infrastructure with regards to roads that we have in this country. I've been around the block a couple of times. I can tell you now, from the road infrastructure perspective, we are there, eh? We are there. But talking about the rough road, in fact, on the cover of the book, I took that picture between Sutherland and Calvinia. It's a gravel road. I'm not sure if you've traveled that part. Yes. That's when I really felt like, yeah, no, now I'm proper driving. It's gravel road. It's got some rut, proper rut.
Mm.
Yeah, that's when I really felt that I'm traveling. And more especially because on certain parts of that trip, it's about 160, 170 kilometers. Certain part of that trip, there is no cell phone network, and it's just farmland. And as I say towards the end of the book, that I did this entire trip without any spare wheel. It's just one of those things. Eh? I discovered the night before, because the car that I was going to use has those spare wheels that are outside underneath the vehicle. So the night before, as I was approaching the car from behind, I realized that, no, man, the car looks different. And then it hit me, no, the spare wheel had been nicked. The reason for that is because a few days earlier, I had gone to watch a game late at night at the stadium, and I knew it was there where they'd nicked the spare wheel. So I just decided, oh, well, I'm just going to do the trip without any spare wheel. And here I am.
Fortunately, you mostly traveled on tar roads.
That helped.
It reminds me of a story. Can I tell it, please?
Of
the Tangpo Karoo. First time I went there, and I stopped there at a farmer, you know, one of the farmers there, and I talked to him, and he said, you know, once a week, once every 2 weeks or whatever. Sure. Then he goes to Colfinia to buy stuff. Yeah. But then for some of the workers, he must buy stuff as well. And they bring little papier keys and bring me this and that. And this one guy came to me, that, you know, the work, you know. I asked him, meneer, come near, asseblief, my vrou, a bra bring, you know, a brazier. And he said, the guy, you asked the guy, now, what size? The guy thinks a little bit, I say, ek weet nie meneer, wat sy dra nommer 6 skoen.
All right. Is that my comment?
Maybe it's some link.
All right. There's, I really think, you know, these two books, like On the Back Roads and Rainbow Notion, Mazulu Arts, they will really sit nicely next to each other on a bookshelf at home, because it really brings very illuminating perspectives and different perspectives also on road trips through the whole of South Africa. And especially Donna is mostly on the gravel roads, and Sisley traveled a lot on the tar roads. You will get a nice full picture of many of the destinations. I saw in On the Back Roads, just now when you both talked about traveling on the open road and traveling alone, Donna, you included a beautiful quote by Bruce Chatwin in your book On the Back Roads, which said, "I was suspended in the beautiful solitude of the open road. There is a kind of introspection that only outdoor space generates, for inside and outside are more intertwined than the usual distinctions allow." So that's also something you experienced during that month, just in terms of that solitude and the open road. It gave you the space to really think about what you were doing and where you were going. Hey?
Well, there is something about the open road that you can never experience in any other way. Yes, aviation is here. Sometimes we have to fly because of distances. But I will urge you, I will encourage you to now and then, you know, forget about the flying aspect, get into the car and drive. And not so much because there is an ultimate destination, but for it just to be about the trip itself. And that is what I appreciated. And that is why, for me, it's very important that I travel alone. Because, as I said earlier on, it gives me that opportunity to think about things. So it's not just about the traveling. It's the perspective. It's the deciding here and now that, okay, let me stop and switch off the engine of this vehicle and just listen to the silence, especially when I was traveling through the Karoo, Northern Cape. That's one of the beautiful things about the Northern Cape, is that it is the largest province, but it's got the least population. So sometimes you can just travel for some time without necessarily coming across other road users. And that's what I liked. It's just stop in the middle of nowhere and switch off the engine and just listen to nature. It's such a beautiful thing.
Donna, you also enjoy those silences, eh?
Yeah, for sure. I think the whole thing about traveling and it fascinates me. And Bruce Chatwin, you know his books and the song lines. He wrote a wonderful book about Australia and the song lines. The book's name is titled "The South Song Lines." Yeah, and what it basically is about is that the Aborigines, their founding myth or whatever, their Genesis, you know, their story, a religious sort of why explaining things, is that their ancestors, they walked, and while they were walking, they were singing the earth into existence. And the whole concept of a walkabout, you know, a guy disappearing one day from work and he's on a walkabout, is to walk that old lines again. And I grew up with the Sun people, the Bushmans up in, not with them, but, you know, they were around. And they was exactly, the guy is working on the farm as a worker, and one morning he's just gone. And he went back to the old Jagdvelde. And I think our ancestors maybe, and that is Chatwin's theory, is that our ancestors were migratory as well. Yeah, up in the plains in Africa, that guys. And that stuff is still inside us. We want to go and we find something. We want to heal something in ourselves just going or whatever.
I know in your
that
book.
That urge to go.
I know. You touch on that thing. It's in us. We were born
with
exploration gene. Just one place is not good enough. You have to go and see other places. And you wonder, but why do I have to go? It's because it's just part of your DNA.
Yeah, that's it. That's
you can never escape it. Part of you wants you to go and experience other places.
When I lived in Pretoria, and then sometimes it happens like that. It must be 2 weeks at home, you know. It must be there. You know, 2 weeks, then I find, like, one evening I just drive to Witbank, you know. I think I can see enough stuff of Ara that nog verleiwillig Witbank to gegaan het. Just take a drive to Witbank. Drink twee doppen, then come back.
What I also find interesting is that, and I fully agree with you, having also spend a big part of my career working at Black & Go magazine and traveling a lot to many of the same destinations that you cover in this book, which I could then also relate to in different ways, is that we have this thing in our DNA, that wanderlust, that makes us want to go explore, but it doesn't stop there. It's a big part of it is also the sharing afterwards, telling the stories. We don't just go and explore and experience. We come back and in some form share it with others. And of course, a big part of what the two of you do is to share it in words and to write these books that the rest of us can read and then, you know, respond to it in our own way. But I was curious, Sihle, in the beginning of your book, you say that there are actually... You only found a few books by South African authors along these themes of doing a road trip throughout the country. Why do the two of you maybe think that there aren't more? If you think of South Africa as such a textured and interesting destination, one would almost expect there to be a bigger body of work of these kind of books.
Yeah, indeed. As we spoke about it before we came on stage, is that... I am of the view that, yes, as South Africans, at least some of us, we do travel. But the difference here is that we did this trip as one massive trip, whereas other people will do a trip here, 3-4 days, come back, continue with life, and then do another trip. So that explains why we do not have. And I certainly hope that more of us South Africans will, number one, travel extensively within our very own country, but also it's very important that we document, we tell the story. We do not necessarily have to agree, but it's very important that you document your perspective. You get to a certain town, you do not like it for whatever reason, you travel through this part of the country for whatever reason, it resonates with you. It's very important that we do not only travel, but that we share that information with the rest of us.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, for sure. But the whole thing about the... I tend to not travel for recreation anymore. Obviously, it's nice to feel the road, but to go and look at stuff. So I will decide I want to go look at whatever, the Busman Tekken and Kenhardt, and then I go there and I try to read about it and that the whole thing. And a story that fascinates me, but I don't think as a white man I will be able to write it really, and that's maybe the thing you must do. I don't want to tell you what to do, but I think you will have a better perspective and you can talk to language and stuff. Or it would be interesting if I can go on a trip and you can go on a trip and we both write something. Is that classic, or classic is not the right word, more tragic? Saul Plaatje, after the 1913 Land Act came into Van Krachtgeword, he traveled through the Northern Cape from Kimberley. He went up actually to the Free State. And with the train, I think he went up to Christiana with the train, and then he took a bicycle. He took his bicycle and he rode with his bicycle through parts of the Free State, documenting it in his native life in Africa, and documenting it and see the effects of this law that came into being. In 1913, the Land Act, I think that's it's sure. only starting to bite now, with the talk of grondvat. want toe mag swart mense net op sekere plekke in die land, only in certain parts, blacks were allowed to own land. And where they were and with their little boerderykies, hulle moes gaan valk of het. And Plaikie went to see the effects. And he wrote about it, and he went over to Britain to go and talk to the king or some fancy Englishman, and that I let nie eens ordentlik vir hom geluister nie. Ga maar weer terug. Geen bietjie kos daar. Kom maar toe, broekies. Go back, man. It would be interesting. I mean, we should do something like, because there is an indication where he went to Hoopstad, I know, and he went to Christiana, and he went to you know to. There must be some of that family still be alive, you know, the and see where, you know, what it will be very interesting. Yeah.
No. I totally agree. I totally agree with you. I've read that book, and as you rightfully say, maybe our perspectives will be different. Mm. In fact, as part of the trip, one of the things that I did, I visited a number of graves for whatever reason. It's kind of strange going into a cemetery to visit a grave of not a friend, not a family member. It was the first time I did it, and it just felt a bit strange. Mm. And one of the graves that I visited is sold.
Yeah, I went to this one.
Yeah, and it's one of those things, and I think he's one of the people that would have played a very critical role in South Africa had he died at a very young age. He was very, very intelligent. Yeah. Could speak almost all the languages.
And he translated Shakespeare into Tswana, is it?
Yes. And not just one book of Shakespeare, I think two or three. So it goes on to show, he was a polyglot. He could speak that language and that language, and he was also a publisher as well. So people like that, they really played a key role, and that is why I amongst other people I visited his grave as part of my
trip. There's Erika Westen, the publisher. So we go on the trip. You write the from your perspective the Plaikie story. I'll do mine. And she pays well, eh?
Yeah. Even publish it together in one book.
Because I think that's the issue now, the whole thing about land. Yeah. And if you talk about the whole land and vergoeding, whatever, that's where we must start at
1913. Yeah, because it did not start there, but it's a critical moment.
Critical moment. Yeah.
Let's talk a bit about the land issue. I mean, especially since you've done your trip, it has become so much more of a bigger national issue in Parliament, in homes where people talk about it and often worry about it, and there's so many perspectives on it. You do say in your book you are of the opinion that whoever owns the land has the wealth, and it's as simple and as complicated as that, but you also write about how South Africa isn't only just divided among racial lines in terms of land, it's also amongst ethnic groups. You know, you will go to a township and there will be the Zulu people, there would be the Sotho. It's also, we are still such a divisive country, even inside the townships, of course. But thinking back of your trip and the subsequent land issue that has become so much a part of our national conversation, what's your perspective on it at the moment?
Okay, just before I get onto that, now that you're talking about the issue of the townships and how also within the township, which was mainly for black African people, in Soweto, by the way, we all know Soweto is an acronym, right, for Southwestern Townships, because that's exactly where it's located, on the southwestern part of the city of Johannesburg. But in Soweto, even there, different ethnic groups were allocated different parts of the township. That is why, as an example, Cyril Ramaphosa was born in Chiawelo. He could have not been born in another part of Soweto because of his ethnic group. He could have only been born there because his parents would have only lived in Chiawelo, not in Orlando, as an example. So that is just one perspective which sometimes as South Africans we are not aware of. We just think, oh, well, township is just like all black African people live. No, even there, there was still discrimination with regards to the different ethnic group that you live in. Now, on the issue of land, in fact, in the book, I talk about some of the key issues that, as a country, we need to deal with. And one of those is the issue of land. It's a very emotional issue. But as I say, and you rightfully quoted me there, that whoever has the land has, it's a wealth issue. I'm not saying that wealth can only be in a landform, but land plays a very critical role. And it's very important that as South Africans we have this very open, very frank conversation amongst ourselves with the issue of land. What I find is that the minute somebody mentions the issue of land, then everybody gets emotional without necessarily dealing with issues on a much more open platform, and also making sure that at the end of the day, there is an issue of give and take. There is an issue of, at the end of the day, you might not necessarily agree, but a solution has to be found. It does not help just to be very emotional when solutions could still be found, even if it's a negotiated one.
Yeah. Such a key issue. It's something we need to talk about it frankly. You know, it's almost like, I think people almost, this is a really random example, just pop into my mind. This is one Fawlty Towers episode where John Cleese is the waiter and there's a Germans at the table, and then he runs around, whatever you do, do not mention the war, you know. It's almost like the new war is the land issue in our country.
It's so difficult to talk about these sensitive issues because, from my perspective as a white man, because if I say, if I talk about my fears, about land or whatever, political fears, then I sound like a racist. And they say, and that's one of the worrying things for me happening, not only here, but in South Africa especially. I, as a wit Afrikaner, wat vir die nasionale party gestem het, wat fokkens spyt daaroor is, maar ek het dit gedoen, ek kan nie daaroor lieg nie. I can't talk about my fears, because then I'll sound like that, oh, you know, like I verlang terug na die verlede, and that's not completely true. And about the land issue, the thing I want to say about it, not just from my own perspective, just myself, not is they can, President Ramaphosa can call me personally tomorrow and say, I give you a farm, wherever you want it, I'll give you a farm, Donna, you have your farm. I say, no, sir, sorry, I can't farm. Het gaan 'n groot gemors op my plaas wees, you know. I can't bloody well farm, I kan nie eers my eie tuin reghou nie. So I will just say, sorry, sir, I can't do it, because I haven't got the talent to farm. And if you look at the economic system, you know, there was a thing in a report yesterday about the only farmers really that can make it at this stage, really make it, is the mega farmers, is the big guys. And it's sad, like it's like that, but that's, they play on the open market, they must sell their, you know, produce there. It's not like you plant your palm milikis now, and you know, things change, and it's a strategy. So I think there must be a sort of a realization about your limits, what you can do with the land, not just to have land, you know. But now it sounds like a racist. You understand what I mean?
No, I don't think it sounds like a racist.
Yeah, well, you understand what I mean? It is, why can't, you know, if you have the talent to farm, and you have, and wherever you are, go and study and give bursaries to people and go and work the land. But this whole emotional thing about land is just, and from the white, in the white community, we very, very, the thing about farm murders is a very emotional thing. And it's, I think statistics, and I don't want to drag my copier in a bayonet, but the statistics show it's not really that much higher. It's higher, but it's not that much higher for murders. It's just, and in most cases, it's crime. It's not like they want to have the Afrikaners into the sea. But it's an emotional thing for us, because in every Afrikaner family, there's a farm somewhere.
Sure.
There's a farm, it's Opa's plaas, or, you know, even if you're in town, even if you grow up in the city, there's still Opa's plaas somewhere. And if there's a farmer murdered, that's that farm inside you. That was, you know.
Okay.
I think,
yeah. Well, I suppose there's a conclusion on this aspect. It's amazing how sometimes things can be racialized, even just the issue of crime.
Yeah.
Because sometimes it's just crime.
I've been a victim
of crime, and a lot of my friends, family members have been a victim of crime. But sometimes the minute you are hijacked, it's almost like you were hijacked because you're a white male, which is not necessarily true. It's because the criminals were just looking for that specific car, or you're at the wrong place at the wrong time, and that's exactly it. It's not your race, it's just that the criminals just wanted that particular car, or you were just wrong place, wrong time, and that's it. And sometimes that could lead you to being a victim of crime. But sometimes then we tend to racialize certain things.
Yeah, for sure. Because I started out as a crime reporter at Belt, 89 or somewhere, and we didn't report any black crime statistics. There was nothing. All the crime statistics were white. And then it's very what is what for more, you know. That's where we level ons gaan, level ons vermoor, you know, and we don't know about, you know, crime situation in townships. So.
Okay.
I want to talk a bit about, you know, monuments and graves and just this a sense of South Africa's and our shared history. Sisle, in your book, I found it very meaningful and illuminating because you write about many historical figures that I've learned about most of them in later years or sort of by self-study or by traveling on my trips for Back and Go, but many of these historical figures hardly ever, they didn't even have a cameo in my history books. They were just not there. You know, somebody like Jeff Masemola of the PAC, I never heard his name before I was even up to the age of 20. He was just never featured in the history books. But in terms of that sense of history, I found it interesting when you started your trip at Sharpeville on your way to the monument there, you were struck by the fact that there were 20-year-olds in the township that had no idea about Sharpeville even. And you say in your book, you say it might be one of the unintended consequences of the Rainbow Nation project. What are your thoughts on the fact that there are so many young people without that sense of history today?
Yeah, it's as I say in the book, it's probably one of those unintended consequences. When I was driving through Sharpeville, I was actually looking for the place. Mm. And I stopped and I looked around, I asked these youngsters, they live there. It's just like, but really, the stare that they gave me when I asked them, but where is the Sharpeville? It's like, but geez, you could just see, you know, when somebody asks you a question of something that you have no clue about. So it's just one of those things. And it's very important, I think, as parents, that we expose our children, our grandchildren to history so that they have a sense of belonging. And it's very important also as well that we expose them to from A to Z. One of the graves that I visited, in fact, I think it's the first grave that I visited, it was on the first day when I was still with the family, was the grave of Paul Kruger. See, it's because he played a critical role in the history of this country. So I cannot just sideline him and say, no, but because I'm a black African, I'm not going to go and see Paul Kruger's grave. So we have to engage with that history. And talking about people who've been wiped off completely from the history, besides just Jeff Masemola, one person that I went to her grave, is actually she is King Shaka's mother. You probably have never heard of her, Queen Nandi. The grave is decimated. It's in the middle of nowhere. Nobody cares about it. And it's kind of strange, and I mention it in the book, but in Durban, there is a nice highway, Queen Nandi Drive. When you listen to the radio sometimes, they'll be like, yeah, there's been a crash, and now there's traffic on Queen Nandi Drive. But then you go and see the grave. It's in the middle of nowhere, desolated. It's just like, but how is this possible? It's because the grave in the middle of nowhere does not create public relations. You know, politicians are for public relations to be seen. But now, a highway, which is going to be mentioned now and then on radio, that gives you the mileage. So it's very important that we as citizens openly talk about such things, more especially other people as well who are just not mentioned in history as well.
Donna, I was at a stand-up comedy gig the other night at Wishkul Jeugland in Kempton Park, and the one stand-up comedian was making a joke about being in Wishkul Waterkloof in his high school years, and then he referenced the Waterkloof field.
Yes.
And as he said it, there was I think it was like a standard 9 girl standing backstage behind the curtains. When she heard that word, she turned to a friend and said, "What's that?" Not even "Wie's that?"
Yeah.
So it's interesting the historical perspective, even recent things that sometimes are, you know, gets
yeah,
lost.
Yeah.
Maybe it's not bad that she doesn't.
It's the whole thing about, and I think you sort of it must be in your dangoka, where it's like, especially me getting older now, it's like I for under my pa, I want to be a preacher. And it's not good for a writer to be a preacher, because it's bloody boring, you know. It's but that urge that you have to tell certain stories, the urge you have to go to Paul Kruger's grave. It's not, you know, everybody's urge, black man's urge to go there. And it's so good that you, I mustn't say it from the top, but you know, it's so nice. And the same for me. I discovered like Steve Bigo played rugby. Steve Bigo was a big, huge rugby fan while he was. And he had this sort of friendly bantering between him and his interrogators about rugby, about, you know, he's more a Gavin Cowley man than a Gerald Bosch man during the 76 All Black tour. And that stuff, and that, I think it's so important for me myself to tell people more about this shared history we have. I spoke this morning to somebody, and there's no big thing in Afrikaner history that happened, like happenings, where there wasn't black people involved as well on our side. So we this groups or whatever you want to call it to generalize, but we're so interlinked. In a sense, and in an unfair sense, you know, at the bottom, but things change. But the thing is, we're so intertwined, and I think that stories must be told. You know, the most credible witness report of the Slag van Bloedrivier, but it's a huge thing in Afrikaner history. Slag van Bloedrivier, here was in our cunt, all that stuff. But the most credible report was written by a brown guy, a colored guy. Bikies. He was a colored guy. He built lots of our history on a witness report of Bikies. But we didn't realize it. On the groot track, you know, part of the Trigard track, you know, there was a brown family. Actually, it was the guy was a Huguenot sort of type of guy, but he had a colored wife with colored children. They were tracking some. I think that's, and nobody teach us that in school, for us, you know. And that to me is like important stories to tell, but then you sound like a preacher.
You also go to Blood River, to Blood River Field. You've been there more than once, you write in the book about it. And those two museums on various sides.
Yeah, crazy.
What's going on there?
Okay, just two issues. The first one is what Dana touched on, is how our history is interlinked or intertwined on one way or the other. Talking about the battle of Blood River, is that obvious? This is in KZN, right? Which is predominantly Zulu speaking. But when the Afrikaners came with black people, they were of Zulu speaking people. And after they defeated the Zulus, they gave this massive tract of land to the Zulu speaking people. And even today, you still have Chief Molefe, obviously, the descendant. They speak Sisutu right bam in the middle of KZN as a result of the battle of Blood River. It's something that, it just put things into perspective. Eh? It's just in the middle of KZN, you'll have just this clan, and they're very close-knit because they are the descendants of those Sutu speaking people who were on the side of the Boers during the Battle of Blood River. Yeah, that's one of the things I talk about in the book. There are actually two museums. The first one is owned by government, Department of Arts and Culture. The other one is privately owned on the other side of the river. And that is one of the things that we need to engage with, that why do you need two museums?
Because one is the Zulu perspective,
yes,
the other one is the Afrikaner perspective.
But that is exactly, that is not right. Why do you need the two, why can't we just openly engage with exactly what happened? Because when you go to the Zulu perspective one, they say, yeah, no, we lost, but those figures, no, they are incorrect. They are we accept that Zulus we lost, but those figures, that not even one African has got a scratch. No, those figures are just, they just give you this like, no, it is not correct. But then when you cross the river and you go to the other side, it's like, yes. That is why it was called the Blood River. And one of the things, by the way, in the book that I talk about, because it was in December, right, the 16th of December, and there was a river that had to be crossed. And history tells us that the Afrikaners were on the other side. I say, as a Zulu person, I say, but Zulus, why didn't they just wait? Why did they have to cross the river? It's just like, why did they have to cross a raging river in summer.
That was a fascinating perspective.
But why? Because now you have to deal with this crossing of the river and you're being shot at. You are just at a disadvantage. I'm not a military analyst, but I've never even been to the army. But I can just say that you're crossing a raging river and people are shooting at you. You are at a disadvantage, I can tell you. So that's what I asked in the book. I'm like, but just like, wait. I mean, you live there, right? These people are coming to you, right? You just wait. Just wait for automation, the way that the river can subside a bit, and then you can engage. You know, but don't try. That's what my takeaway home. Don't try cross a raging river when somebody's shooting at you. You're not going to win that battle.
Mole, eh?
It's no pressure, but everybody who's been laughing in the past 45 minutes, please buy the book, because you will have so more laughs, because Sisley also, the way he speaks is also the way he writes and reflects, and it's absolutely delightful. One of the key points in your book is at around 150, it also, I think, ties in with the title in a way, where you write about this notion of the Rainbow Nation, and I would like to have both of your perspectives on it, because you say that, you know, when Cyril Ramaphosa, Ruth Meyer, all were involved in that process of the Constitution in the early 90s, there was this hope for a rainbow nation. I think Desmond Tutu, to a big extent, was almost the poster boy of that ideal. But now we are a nation in the rainbow. Diverse groups of people who are just tolerating one another and deep down, driven by mistrust, resentment, and sometimes hatred of their fellow citizens. With every passing day, these feelings become more and more entrenched. One hopes future generations will be able to overcome such hatred. But, it's...
I honestly think Rainbow Nation as a vision, as what as a nation you're hoping for, was a great thing. It's just that somehow we as South Africans, for whatever reason, just believed that we already had achieved it purely because we voted in 1994. And I think without necessarily dealing with certain issues, some very difficult, very frank observations and conversations had to be had, but we did not. We just said, everybody voted on the 27th of April in 1994, so now we are a rainbow nation. And I'm of the firm view that, no, we are not there. It is something that we need to work towards. We are not there in terms of race relations. If we were, you and I would not know a lady by, say, Vicky Momberg or Penny Sparrow, as an example. Because such videos and such social media things, when they come up, they show that we are not where we think we are. And it's very important that we acknowledge that from a race relations, we are not where we think we are. I tend to make friends with black people. All your friends are probably white. Why? Even your children as well. You know, we need also to be conscious of what we say when we're at home with our children, because that influences them, even if they are going to multiracial schools. But because of the influence that you have as a parent, as a grandparent, that will also entrench certain views. So I'm of the view that it was a great thing, it was a great vision, but we are not where we think we are. And now and then there will be those incidents that will show on the media that will make you take note as a South African that, no, the Rainbow Nation was a great dream, but we still have to work towards it. We are not there as yet. And we still are, still a while before we achieve it.
Donna?
I completely agree. Actually, I defer on one point. I think we will never be able to achieve it, in the sense that because we're human beings, we're not perfect. The main society is very unformed, as you say. So it will always be there. There will always be conflict, you know, between people. But we can strive for that. And I'm on a point in my personal life, because I'm a human being. I think you will agree with that. You're a human being first, and then you're a writer. And in my personal life, I sort of, we're not nearly there. But I don't sit too much around in coffee shops and talk too much about it, and go to, you know, these types of talking. I try really, and one mustn't say it, and you know, it's just saying your right hand mustn't know what your left hand is doing, you know, you mustn't. But, you know, just in your personal life, to try and be a nice oak, you know, to everybody. And many middle fingers for owns and three spiegel guys and sucker small things. I don't dream too big anymore. Because, you know, the big dream is that I talk, coffee shops, whatever, seminar, talk. I really believe in just trying to, where I go out here, whatever, to try and to live that thing. And I think it's here. But I think if people try have that perspective, because we have this big perspective, yeah, we want to, you know, it's only laundry, you know, and never done, you know, and then at the end it's just talk. Rather say, no man, I'm going to go net vandaag hier aan. And I try and do a, you know, meaningful stuff. But in the Afrikaans, what worries me is about this whole hard track again, you know, this the EFF coming for us, you know, and that type of thing. And now we have a sort of a terugverlang naar nostalgic sort of longing for, you know, where we thought it was better. We thought it was better. The townships after, the townships were behind the hill, and, you know, everything. There was no crime here in the Woongebied, you know, and now I think we can have it again. It's impossible.
Yep.
It's unrealistic if people preach that message of, you know, it's, we must work together.
Yeah, sure. And talking about that, what we're talking about here, it has to be a conscious effort. And I think sometimes as South Africans, we just want to go through this autopilot. It has to be a conscious effort. Yeah. And sometimes we might not be aware of it, but we are forever profiling people. Let me make this practical example. You know, if I stand in a queue at a local supermarket, and you stand behind a lady, and I stand behind exactly the same lady, I will just see the way she will just slightly, I'm talking about white lady, slightly just pull her handbag and just hold it closer. Just, you know, it's just that profiling. You know, sometimes she's not even consciously aware of it that she's doing that. But now, just because there's just the black man following her at the local supermarket compared to if it was
for
white.
For sure.
It's just those small things.
Yeah.
And it's very important that we talk about it so that you'll be aware when you do it, that you wouldn't have done that if it was Dana who was standing behind you in a queue. But now, because it's me and you don't know me, this thing is happening. Yeah. And just another practical example, I went to Natal Technical, now called Durban University of Technology. The residence that I was staying in was not in campus. So now and then, we'll have to walk at night from main campus to the residence. And I will always see it. I'll be walking, I'm stressed about the exam the following day, but as I'm just walking, you'll just see, because I'm a black man approaching, there's a red robot, and this driver sees a black man approaching, it's 8, 9 o'clock at night. And it's unlike now where you have central locking in cars. You'll just see the driver saying something to the other people in the car, and you'll all see them locking the doors. You know, it's just that you need to be aware of such things, and it's very important that we talk about that. If you talk to someone who was hijacked, they'll say, I never saw that person coming. So if you can see me coming from afar, 9 out of 10 times, I'm not that guy. But we need to be consciously aware. It's just small things. It's just those small things where you cross the road just because I'm coming, we're on the same side of the road, and then all of a sudden you conveniently cross and you walk on the other side of the road. It's just we think it's small things. Sometimes it's an uncle, you are not even just like, let me, but you just do it. It's a conscious thing. We need to just, it's called minor things, but they make a big difference.
I can't agree more. And that's, earlier I spoke about the whole thing of talking about my fears, and that's exactly the same thing. Because if I exactly do that. You know, when a black man is, you know, you have that thing. Remember, we grew up, you know, part of that stuff is also in here. You know, that thing about you must be afraid of black people, you're better than black people, you know, black, I can't be clever, you know, that whole thing. In my conscience, my reason side, my left-hand side or whatever, in my brain, I know it's shit. But in my right-hand side, it is 40, 50 years of growing up, and that stuff was printed into my corp. So you react in certain ways. You can't really help, in a sense. Only way you can help is to talk about it, to talk about your fears, to say every day, I don't want to be a racist, you know? Because a guy that tells you he's not a racist of my age,
is
obviously he doesn't want to be, you don't want to be a racist like me, but certain way you react, he's racist, and you must just fight it. But it's small things. You must understand what I mean. You it's a constant struggle. If you're honest about it, you know, you can't just say, "Darag jaar gone." Grew up in like national apartheid, the whole thing. Yeah, no, you can't just say, oh, did it happen? You know, it happened, and it fucked us up inside. You know.
Yeah.
And now we want to unfuck ourselves. You know.
I know. But that is why, as I said earlier on, it's very important that when we engage, especially with the young ones. Some of us, as you say, 50 years down the line, certain things you cannot undo. They were told to you. You saw them happening over a long period of time. But for the young ones, it's very important. The conversations that you think they are private conversations because you're at home, but they are listening. When you're in the car and a black person crosses the road and it's red and you have to hoot and you'll be like, what do you expect? You see that, it just, you know, to a 6-7 year old, it creates an impression. So we have to be conscious of these things, especially for the young ones. Because yes, some of us are old, but the young ones still have to run this country and do a lot of beautiful things for this wonderful country. But it's how we bring them up, especially in those confines where we think it's private, homes, cars, and when they are playing. It's very important that we be aware of such things.
Wow, so much food for thought. I think we are pretty much at the end of our session, but I would like to give opportunity, if there are questions from the audience, there is a roaming mic there in the middle with Michael. If you have questions, just raise your hand. We have a minute or two for questions from the audience. If there are no questions, I will ask another question, but there's a hand.
I feel that to be confronted is often confrontational, but telling a story is, I think, confronts one at a much deeper level, when you can go think about it like when you travel, when you can go think about it on your own. So I want to thank you both of you for taking the courage of telling a story from your perspective, because we all only have our own perspectives. And I think the other thing is that it's not really a question, but if I listen to you, what we basically need to be kind in our thoughts and in the way that we talk about each other in front of people and in our own, and the way that we think about people as well. Because that's the only way we're really going to get to know each other well. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Any more questions at this point?
There's one thing I want to touch on, which maybe we did not. In the book, I talk about a number of issues that we as South Africans need to deal with. We've spoken about the issue of land, we've spoken about the issue of race and racism. One issue which we haven't touched on is the issue of education and the education system. I really think as South Africans, we deserve better from that perspective. I'm sure all of us have been aware that the education system that we have is not the best thereof. However, why are we not speaking much about it? It's because our kids and our grandkids go to good schools. So the rest of them is their problem. But that's the problem. It's because when we do not want to engage with issues on a national scale, because that is a national issue. When I was doing this trip, I remember specifically I was in KZN, I was in Richards Bay. My sister lives in Richards Bay. It was on the day when the Department of Education said, for mathematics, we are going to raise it from 30% to 20% past month for mathematics. I thought this is going to be one major issue in South Africa. There's going to be hashtag this, hashtag that. There was nothing. We just all accepted that now you can get 20% in mathematics and you can still go through to the next grade. That is a problem that we should engage with as a nation, as South Africans. But we are not doing that because your children might not necessarily be getting 95% in mathematics, but they're also not getting 20%. So you as a parent are comfortable. It's exactly the same issue when there is news that a certain learner drowned in a pit latrine in the Eastern Cape or in Limpopo, as it happened 2 years ago. There was no outrage. You know why? Because our children go to schools where they are flushing toilets. So that is just a problem for other people. So as a nation, it's very important when such things happen, we get engaged. Notwithstanding that your child will never ever have that issue, that risk of drowning in a pit latrine because they've got flushing toilets. But as South Africans, we need to have that sense of nationhood. I talk about it in the book, how there was that incident or accident on the M13 when you're driving down towards Durban, and 20 or 21 people died just like that when the truck rammed onto a taxi. You see, we talked about it the following day at work, but it was not a big issue in the big scheme of things. In other countries, the National Minister of Transport will resign the following day. There will be so much outrage. How can more than 20 people die in an instant like that? In this country, more than 1,000 people die December. We know it's going to happen, and it happens. But we just take it. So it's very important that certain issues we need to engage, even if it does not affect you directly as an individual. But because you're a South African, it has to affect you. When the government says we are dropping this pass mark to 20%, it has to affect you, because in the long term it's going to affect your kids. It has to. The future criminals, we are molding them today, is the fact of life. The very people who will one day be criminals, they are being molded today through the education system. It's very important that we engage with this on a much more conscious basis, even if it does not affect you as an individual right now.
Well, well. It was the floor after, Franz.
I think I want to link on to the point of education and also what you started with the idea of wealth.
Yeah.
To me, the elephant in the room is the fact that we are still, to a large extent, divided along those lines of education and wealth. It's really, really important. And I tell you why. I put the cart before the horse compared to most people, and that is because I think white people have developed expectations of black people being poor and uneducated. And that leads to prejudice. It's not the other way around. I don't think you can eliminate the prejudice and then we do all these other things. I think we must rebuild the country in terms of wealth and education, and the rest will fall in place. That's just a personal view, but I do believe those are the practical things. Donna spoke about practical things. That's one of them, is wealth creation. In other words, how do you get a nation of majority unemployed and poverty-stricken people to normality? Because I believe that will make a huge stride towards restoring trust amongst the different groupings. That's just a view. I don't know what you think.
Okay. No, it stems home. You know, it's, especially when you travel. I took a train trip through the country, a couple of train trips recently, and I don't think we realize how arm is immense, eh? How poor the people are.
Inequality, eh?
It's scary how poor the people are, eh? Most people. As I said, all I can do is, you know, do my thing, you know. But as a country, yeah, for sure. And, things are so skiff, eh? Like, with people having billions and other people have nothing, and I don't know what to say. It's just bloody sad.
Maybe your last thoughts on that?
Yeah, let me finalize on this side. You know, now and then you will read in a newspaper that a 12-year-old raped a 10-year-old. You know, you get those stories sometimes, and you think, but how is this possible? And other people say, no, it's the TV. No, it's the cell phones. Trust me, yes, that might contribute, but I'll tell you one of the key things that we do not want to talk about. You know what? It's people in informal settlements, there's no privacy.
For sure.
We don't want to talk about that. The parents share the same space with 9, 10, 11, 12-year-olds. The bedroom is here. Everything is here. So these kids are exposed to things that you and I were never exposed to.
But
That is the elephant in the room that nobody wants to do. How this issue of poverty, then we want to deal with a 12-year-old, he's bad, he must go to prison. Yes, for sure, I agree with that. But there is an underlying issue. Where did this 12-year-old learn all this stuff? It's because he's exposed to things that you were never exposed to as a 10-year-old. It's all because of poverty. It's all because of living in an informal settlement where there is no privacy for parents.
And the whole thing about like practical things, we always say, hulle praat so hard. Waarom praat die swarte so hard? You know, hulle praat so hard, you know? And it's because of, I think the way that people live is as well, you know, close together and that whole thing. Why are they stand so close to you? Why, That type of thinking, and I think it's also out of the townships and the way people grew up and they live.
Yeah, but obvious also links to that, and also very important is the importance of just accepting that other people, they tend to talk a bit louder than others. Yeah. That it's, why must it be this standard, that this is the correct standard? Yeah. Your tone of voice, you know, when I'm talking to you, I must have talked like that. The minute I'm like, ha, 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 it's like, but why does he have to laugh so loud? No, it's just, it's okay. Yeah. Just learning to accept that it is okay that somebody can laugh out loud. And there's nothing that shows that he is uncivilized because he's laughing out so loud.
Yeah. On that note, with a few laughs in the audience, you also laugh and think when you read the book. Thanks so much, Donna and Sisley, for your time. It was a wonderful discussion. It really made me think. And enjoy the rest of your festival. Sisley will be here to sign a few books, I'm sure. He will be there, I think. So at the bookshop next door. And thank